From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump tweeted out that he'd strongly consider supplying written testimony to the House committee holding the impeachment inquiry, a tweet that was in response to Nancy Pelosi's comment on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday that he was free to do just that. Meanwhile, we head into week two of public hearings. The marquee event is Wednesday, when Gordon Sondland, U.S. ambassador to the EU, and Trump's self-proclaimed point person in talking to Ukraine about trading aid for investigations. New reporting from the Wall Street Journal says he kept others in the administration up to date on those talks. Testifying tomorrow, two officials who were on the July 25th phone call between the president and his counterpart in Ukraine, and two officials Republicans have called for. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us from Capitol Hill. And Susan, start with, you know, over the weekend, the president tweeting an attack on Jennifer Williams, who's testifying tomorrow. He called her Mike Pence aide, a never-Trumper. She did say in closed-door testimony she was disturbed by that July 25th phone call. But she's more than a Pence aide. She's with the State Department. Does this complicate things for Republicans trying to defend the president? Are they also willing to throw the State Department, you know, under the bus?
Well, Mike Pence's office has made clear that she is a State Department employee, and they are technically correct. She's a career Foreign Service officer. She is an expert on Russia and Europe policy, and she is a detailee to Vice President Mike Pence's office. She is one of the numerous officials that were on the July 25th phone call. And, you know, to the attack of this, for that the president that we've heard from him before, calling her a never-Trumper, suggesting a political motive, there's no evidence of that. This is just a similar line of defense from the White House. He's used it against people like Bill Taylor, the top diplomat in Ukraine, and Alexander Vindman, who works over at the NSC.
Now, we'll talk about the defenses that we're hearing from Republicans. People like Jim Jordan of Ohio saying that the aid, the military aid, was ultimately delivered. So the ask for investigations in exchange for aid doesn't matter anymore if the aid was delivered. And then you have Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin defending the president by blaming the whistleblower. Here he is on NBC's Meet the Press.
This would have been far better off if we would have just taken care of this behind the scenes. We have two branches of government.
Okay.
Most people wanted to support Ukraine. We were trying to convince President Trump. And so the whole, I mean, again, I listened to the Washington Post article lionizing this whistleblower. Listen, if the whistleblower's goal is to improve our relationship with Ukraine, he utterly failed.
So a suggestion there that this would have been great if it was behind the curtains, nothing to see here. But are you hearing people maybe also on the Hill thinking the opposite, that without the whistleblower and without a democratically led House, the president might actually have been able to pull off what the Democrats are calling a bribe and not just threatening it?
Well, first, you know, to the attacks on the whistleblower, people should be clear that the laws protecting whistleblowers were laws enacted by Congress. So there's nothing that's happening there that wasn't without the consent and intent of Congress to be able to protect people who raise red flags about the workings inside the government and especially inside the intelligence community, which is particularly impenetrable. I think the crux of the Republican defense has been not to dispute that the events happened. They did. I don't think there's any real disagreement about that. Just that they're not impeachable offenses. And they point to, as you said, the fact that the aid flowed, the fact that investigations were never conditioned on that aid. We should note, though, that Democrats continue to point out that their metric for impeachment is not that there had to be necessarily an exchange, but just the ask alone, the pressure alone is something that could be considered attempted bribery and something that would be worthy of impeachment.
Yeah, we keep the phrase over and over. We keep hearing just because you're breaking into the House and you get stopped while breaking into the House, you still are a burglar breaking into the House.
Right. Just when someone leaves the keys under the mat, you go into their home.
Not your fault. I just want to ask about the people that the Republicans would like to hear from tomorrow afternoon. Kurt Volker, former special envoy to Ukraine, who worked with Gordon Sondland. Tim Morrison, another National Security Council aide who was on that July 25th call. He said he didn't hear anything unlawful in the call, but he also said he went right to John Bolton to let him know about it.
Well, two of the reasons that Republicans want to hear from these two is that, from their view, there are two voices that could provide testimony that could benefit the White House's case. You know, they're both respected voices inside both the State Department and the national security community. Volker is someone who is known for his commitment to the U.S. alliance with Ukraine. And Morrison, as you said, testified in his private deposition that has been his transcripts were released and we'll hear publicly that he did not see that there was any legal issues raised in the call to his ear. That is obviously something Republicans Republicans would like to have him say on television, and so the public can hear it too. But it's not necessarily up to Tim Morrison. I mean, the question of impeachment and whether they want to move forward with it is something squarely in the lane of Congress. The staffer's input on that may not be something that is particularly moving to Democrats.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can't go a day these days without hearing about these.
A new Quinnipiac poll has Joe Biden leading.
Point lead in this poll for Joe Biden up against Elizabeth Warren.
A series of brand new polls from the six battleground states that determine the outcome of the election in 2016.
Polls. They tell us who's behind, who's in the lead, who people like, and what issues are important. The latest poll, according to the Des Moines Register CNN MediaCom, shows Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg up 16 points among Iowa's Democratic caucus goers, with 25% saying Buttigieg is their first choice for president. But how credible are polls? And is every one of them created equally? To help us understand this, we have with us Nathaniel Rakich. He's elections analyst at 538. Hey, Nathaniel.
Hi, Tanya.
After the 2016 election, analysis by several academic organizations found that state-level polling underestimated the level of President Trump's support, especially in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. I'm just wondering, in light of our political climate and divisiveness, how credible polls are really in giving us an assessment of who's leading and who's not.
Yeah, so polls overall remain very good. They're quite accurate. For example, in the 2018 election, they were among the most accurate they've ever been. That said, of course, there are always going to be margins of error and slight differentiations. And for things like the 2016 election, national polls were actually quite good. I think the final national polling average was something like Hillary Clinton plus 3. And of course, she ended up winning the popular vote by 2. So those polls were pretty much right on the money. The issue was the distribution of President Trump support and these kind of blind spot states that either weren't very well polled or weren't polled at all.
Okay, so polls aren't just predictive. They now dictate which candidates will participate in this Wednesday's Democratic primary debate in Atlanta. And presidential candidate Julian Castro will not be on the debate stage this Wednesday. He met the fundraising requirement, but not the polling requirement. And he was recently very critical of the Democratic primaries beginning in Iowa and New Hampshire. We have a clip.
We can't say to black women, oh, thank you, you're the ones that are powering our victories in places like Alabama and in 2018, and then turn around and start our nominating contest in the two states that have barely any black people in them.
Your thoughts on Castro's critique, especially as it relates to early state polls?
Yeah, so, you know, I think I'll leave it to people who are smarter than I am to decide which states should go first. That said, in terms of, if Castro were trying to imply that the lack of non-white voters in those states is the reason that he didn't get the polls to qualify for the debate, I don't think that would be true. And that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, polls from multiple different geographies count for debate qualification. So national polls, which obviously are meant to be representative of the nation's demographics, but also polls of South Carolina and Nevada also can qualify you to be in the debate. That said, I do think that it's fair to say that there has been an overemphasis of Iowa and New Hampshire relative to South Carolina and Nevada in the media and among pollsters. You know, if Nevada had had 10 polls coming out of it in the last month, the way that an Iowa has, maybe Castro would have reached a 3% in some of those polls.
Okay, let me ask you something that is really a pet peeve of mine. I used to remember that news organizations referenced where they got their polling information, but really these days there are so many that just say, polls say. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was really aggravated by news articles about how unpopular Democratic candidate Pete Buttigieg is among black Americans. And none of these articles had a source for the polls that they were referencing. So I want to know, should people be suspicious of this kind of attribution? And what would you tell them to do, as we have so many sources that we're getting news from, and we don't always have the source of where this polling information comes from?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would certainly say that unless there is a link to the poll or at least some attribution, you should be suspicious. I think generally mainstream media outlets are pretty good about providing some sort of attribution. But certainly when you see someone tweeting, for example, polls say, or maybe when somebody with an agenda like a candidate refers to it, that's when it should send up red flags.
So what are your top three tips for how people should read poll information?
First is, I would say, pay attention to who is doing the polling. So the name of the pollster and their prior reputation. So again, for this, you can go to 538.com and look at our pollster ratings. You know, a pollster with a grade of A is more trustworthy than a pollster with a grade of D. The second thing I would recommend that people look out for is to pay attention to the margin of error. So as I mentioned, every poll has a margin of error, plus or minus 3 points, plus or minus 5 points. If a candidate is leading by one, but the margin of error is three, you should really think of that as more of a tie. And then third, I would say that people shouldn't overreact to outlier polls. We always recommend that people look at a polling average rather than one poll.
And we will have all of the information on your gold standard list at hereandnow.org. That's Nathaniel Rakich, election analyst at 538. Thank you so much, Nathaniel.
You're welcome.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As we've noted, this week's impeachment hearings will feature several key witnesses in the inquiry into whether President Trump pressured the president of Ukraine to investigate potential 2020 rival Joe Biden in exchange for military aid, something House leaders are now calling bribery. The most anticipated witness? Well, probably Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, a witness who said he overheard a conversation Sondland had with President Trump about a potential swap of aid for investigations. Said that afterwards, Sondland told him that President Trump cared only about that. He did not care about Ukraine. Well, the BBC's Jonah Fisher joins us from Kiev, where he's been taking the measure of Ukrainian reaction to the impeachment inquiry. Jonah, are people paying attention?
To a certain extent, I think they were following this quite closely at the start when we had the transcript of the telephone call between Ukraine's President Zelensky and President Trump. When that was released, I think people were quite engaged here, in particular because it gave them a bit of an insight into how their own president operated. I think since then, attention has largely waned as the story has really moved into this impeachment inquiry in Washington itself. Right. People here are kind of slightly bemused, I think it had to be said. And I think the political class here are deeply worried about the way Ukraine is being described and portrayed to the rest of the world, because, you know, you've been watching those hearings the same as everybody else, and Ukraine is not coming well out of it. Lots of pretty senior American figures are coming forward and saying some pretty derogatory things about corruption and the way things work in this country. So I think those people who are still engaged are pretty concerned about the reputational damage that's being done to this country.
Well, we also understand that anti-corruption activists are very engaged, because some of the figures that were in the Trump-Giuliani orbit are the very people they've been trying to fight, who they feel have been trying to take down their country through corruption. Now to find out that the Trump administration has been, you know, rubbing shoulders with them, that's been upsetting. But President Zelensky, what has he said? We know he sat down with some press after this all broke and said something like, I wanted to be world famous, but not in this way. You know, what has he said?
Initially, when President Zelensky was asked for comments about this, you'll remember there was a press conference in New York when President Zelensky sat down with President Trump. He said there was no pressure, and we've heard President Trump repeat that numerous times, that there was no pressure, that it was a perfect call. What we've seen in the weeks since then is that evidence coming out that there was indeed things going on behind the scenes in text messages and communications between aides to Mr. Zelensky and the various official and irregular lines of communication from the United States. But the decision has been taken, and it seems to have been largely accepted within the senior echelons of government and amongst the elites here, that Ukraine is only going to harm itself by providing further details about those interactions, which is why really we've heard the details coming from the United States and not from the officials here who were dealing with the various diplomats and American channels.
Well, it's sort of, we're hearing it described as sort of an existential problem right now because they've got this war in the east, Russian-backed separatists in the east of the country. Ukraine, which broke away from Russia years ago, is trying to keep Russia out of its affairs. It needs American support, including that military aid, to do that. I'm wondering if some Ukrainians would have sympathy for their president if indeed turns out, as some of the witnesses are saying, there was this, you know, this offer, this bribe to provide the aid only if these investigations happen, because this country so desperately needs the U.S. right now.
Yeah, that's right. Ukraine is in a horrible position. The pressure that has undoubtedly been put on this new president, you have to remember President Zelensky is a complete newcomer to the political world. He's really been thrown in the absolute deep end here with this crisis emerging so quickly in his presidency. Ukraine cannot afford to lose that American support, which is why they have been treading so carefully here, yeah. And that they've been so worried when that military aid, that nearly $400 million of U.S. military aid was held back. It wasn't just about the equipment that wasn't going to come this way, but it was really about the symbolism of it, because Ukraine has really needed to feel that it's got the United States backing it up if Russia should step up their aggression in the east. Yeah. At the moment, and following this very difficult summer, I just don't think the Ukrainian government here feel that they've got America watching their back any longer.
Well, and with that, it reminds us of a Kiev Post newspaper front page. This is the English-speaking newspaper in Kiev, and this front page went viral. It had a huge headline that said, "Shady cast of characters." And underneath was President Trump, right under the word shady, and then all of the people who have been involved in what some would say has been a huge scandal. What is the feeling about Donald Trump in Ukraine?
It does depend who you speak to. But dating back to as far as 2016, people here have been deeply worried about Donald Trump. Even when he was a candidate, he was already talking about the possibility of accepting that this peninsula here in Ukraine, Crimea, that it should be accepted now as part of Russia. Russia annexed it back in 2014. So already people were concerned about President Trump and what he might mean for Ukraine and the strength of his support for Ukraine in its kind of conflict with Russia in the east. Mm. I think those concerns have only really grown over the last several years. Yes, the Trump administration has approved lethal assistance, the provision of actual weapons to the Ukrainian military. But what has been coming out over the last several weeks about the interactions behind the scenes, it really has become clear that the Trump administration is not a rock solid backer of the Ukrainian authorities. And indeed, I think a lot of Ukrainians here would not be sorry if either through the next election or through some other process, perhaps the impeachment process, that Mr. Trump was to be removed from office. I don't think there would be that many Ukrainians who were sorry to see him go.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher from Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. Jonah, thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
In Hawaii, record-breaking heat this past summer has scientists warning the result may be the worst coral bleaching that state has ever seen. Coral reefs protect coastlines, shelter fish, which become food. Bleaching can kill coral. On Oahu, researchers are now engaged in a one-of-a-kind effort to document the reefs. Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty accompanied one of the research teams on a recent survey.
You have to take a boat just to get to the labs of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Researchers at the facility on Coconut Island study all kinds of ocean life, with a special focus on coral reefs. My guide is Shreya Yadav, a PhD candidate with the Maiden Lab.
We're going to be visiting a few of the patch reefs around the bay here that we've been tracking over the past few months.
Hawaii started breaking regional heat records back in May, a pattern that puts extreme stress on the state's coral reefs, leading to a potentially life-threatening condition called bleaching. In August, researchers began photographing 30 patch reefs in Kaneohe Bay, creating a record of healthy reefs going through bleaching. In Hawaii, yearly ocean temperatures peak in September and October. Out in the bay, three researchers swim in a spiral pattern, taking underwater photos. They capture between 2 and 5,000 images at each site, ultimately to create a detailed time lapse of the bleaching event. Although environmental factors like temperature play a big role in bleaching, the corals themselves are also important. Mariana Rocha de Souza works in the Ruth Gates Coral Lab studying genetic diversity of different corals.
In an event where there is high temperature or any stressor, having genetic diversity means some of the organisms are going to respond differently. Some of the organisms are going to be able to survive that stressor. So it's very important to know the genetic diversity.
When the swimmers return to the boat, they report evidence of those varying reactions.
All the Boston Opera here is beginning to die. That's the thing that we've seen gone from being totally healthy to fully bleached to now mostly dead. But the other species, some of them look okay. Yeah.
In another part of the bay, I see that firsthand. Hundreds of individual corals make up this reef. It's taken millions of years for it to reach within a foot or two of the ocean's surface from the surrounding sea floor 50 feet below. The team reports certain varieties of coral seem to be bleaching more than others, and often a bleached coral sits right beside a similar healthy colony. Back on Coconut Island, that is the mystery scientists are investigating. At the Coral Reef Ecology Lab, a dozen tanks hold transplanted coral fragments. They're used to study how environmental factors impact bleaching. Scientists can manipulate the temperature and nutrient levels in each tank to learn how those conditions affect the coral. Marine biologist Kuule Rogers oversees the lab and points out the varying reactions.
See, these are all dead. Heated. They're all dead. But you see these? The mushroom coral? They're not dead. They're very pale or starting to bleach, but they're not dead.
Rogers says corals can recover from bleaching, but only if they have enough time in between stress events.
It used to be 25 to 30 years between bleaching events. Recently, it's gone down to every 6 years Hawaii will have a bleaching event. And it may be even less than that as time is going on.
Findings from the bleaching experiment show that corals in Kaneohe Bay have naturally developed a higher tolerance for heat over the past 40 years. But that adaptation is likely not happening fast enough. The goal of this research is to better identify what environmental factors stress corals and then drive public policy accordingly. But Rogers cautions that none of those changes can be a substitute for reducing the atmospheric carbon emissions driving temperatures higher each year. For Here and Now, I'm Ryan Finnerty in Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii.
On our brand new season of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, you'll hear challenging conversations between friends, family members, and sometimes people who could have easily been enemies as they bridge divides and build connections where you'd least expect it. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
WeWork, the troubled office space company, could announce huge layoffs as early as this week. According to sources familiar with the matter, WeWork is planning to lay off about 4,000 employees. That's about a third of its workforce. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so we've been reporting on how dire things have been for WeWork for a long time, ever since it scrapped its IPO in September. Remind us how this company really went from being one of the most anticipated IPOs this year to laying off 4,000 of its 12,000 plus workers, I mean, in just a few months.
Yeah, we have to wind the clock back a little bit. We have a serial entrepreneur from Israel named Adam Neumann. He started the co-working space back in 2010. And, you know, it didn't really see itself as a real estate or a rental company. It saw itself as a tech company. It would ride the wave of young business owners and innovators. They would all want community and kombucha, whatever else you need. It was growing quickly, but really things got supercharged in 2017. The company snagged a more than $4 billion investment from a Japanese executive called Masayoshi San, or Masa. He runs the SoftBank Vision Fund. And that really was like sort of the beginning of the hyper growth period. And frankly, at the beginning of the year, WeWork was about to go public. They thought a $47 billion valuation. Everyone got the IPO document and said, this company doesn't make any money. There's no clear path to a profit. We're going to maybe not do this. And they scrapped the IPO.
You mentioned Adam Neumann. He's the founder and former CEO. He is walking away with an exit package of $1 billion. He'll also be an advisor for the company. A lot of employees understandably angry about the layoffs and this payout. What happens next for WeWork?
you know, I don't make any judgment here about what this guy, who he is. I just will say that there are many people who've been watching this company saying this dude was pulling money out of the company at a really astounding rate. So now, with the company's valuation change, SoftBank has committed even more money, many more billions, to bail the company out. This is probably a face-saving, not a money-making move. And you know what happens now? Corporate America, they say, oh, this is the right sizing of the business, which means layoffs, outsourcing of cleaning and facilities jobs, shuttering unprofitable other businesses. And frankly, the workers take it on the chin. Workers at the company have formed a new group. It's called the We Workers Coalition, and they are trying to get severance packages for those who are getting booted out the door.
Yeah, looking at the larger picture, I'm wondering if this is a wake-up call for other startups out there. Some startups reportedly have begun hoarding cash. Tell us why.
Well, I mean, you can't look at this WeWork story and not understand that valuation is not the same thing as profitability. Valuations rise and fall based on animal spirits, not fundamentals. And so what companies are doing now is they're focusing on profitability versus growth at any cost. They are raising capital not for expansion, to beef up those cash holdings just in case. It's almost like a nice emergency reserve fund.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Do you have a dog? Well, researchers from more than half a dozen universities across the country are embarking, on what may be the largest open study on aging ever undertaken, and the subjects are going to be dogs, maybe yours. It's funded by a $50 million grant from the National Council on Aging, part of the National Institutes of Health, and the goal is to find out about human aging by studying dogs, because both share many of the same diseases, genetic markers, and personality traits. The difference, of course, is that with shorter lifespans, the aging process in dogs unspools more quickly. Sad, but they can teach us things about humans. And the cool thing is, owners of dogs picked for the project can also learn about their dogs. Daniel Promislow is a professor of pathology and biology at the University of Washington. He's founding director of the Canine Longevity Consortium and co-leader of the Dog Aging Project. We spoke to him nearly 4 years ago when this project was in its infancy. Now it's officially underway. We'll have links at herenow.org. So Daniel, start with more about why dogs.
Dogs are a great study system, and in fact, not only to learn about human aging, but to learn about dog aging as well. The other reason that dogs are so great to study is because they are so variable. Just take a walk in a dog park or along a busy street. There are big dogs, small dogs. Dogs vary in their behavior, and dogs also vary in how long they live. From the largest breeds, which might only live 6 or 7 years on average, to the smallest breeds, which could easily live 17 or 18 years. And each breed has its unique spectrum of diseases. We also know that, in general, mixed breed dogs or mutts tend to live longer than purebred dogs. So there's a huge amount of variation, but everything is sped up so that what would take many decades to learn in humans, we can learn from dogs in just a few years.
That's why they say that for every dog year, it's 7 human years. And that can be heartbreaking. You know, if you have a dog that only makes it to 6 or 7 years, I had a Chihuahua that made it to 19. So you're going to have people, and we'll at herenow.org, we'll tell them exactly how to do this. They can nominate their dog. So how do they do this? What is it that you want to know from them?
It's so easy. All you have to do is go to dogagingproject.org. You'll see a little button there to nominate your dog. And there are a couple of steps. The first step is to fill out a really easy survey. It'll just take you 2 or 3 minutes, your name and your dog's name, a little bit about your dog. And then shortly after that, might be a couple of weeks, after you fill out that, we'll take all that information in, and then we'll begin inviting people to fill out a health and life experience survey that will tell us all about your dog. And as soon as you complete that survey, we can start doing science with your dog.
Okay. And then we understand that the Dog Aging Project is also going to have a small number of dogs as opposed to the huge number that you're going to have in the age study. A small number of dogs that might also be chosen for a clinical trial of rapamycin?
So we're going to be collecting samples from 10,000 dogs for the longitudinal study. We like to think of that study as really illustrating the power of paying attention and just watching what happens over years and years as dogs get older. This is going to be the largest study of aging in dogs that anyone has ever done. And about 4% or 5% of those 10,000 dogs will be enrolled in a clinical study testing the ability of a drug called rapamycin to improve what we call health span or healthy lifespan. In the lab, rapamycin makes worms and flies and mice live healthier longer. We want to find out if that's true in dogs as well.
And, of course, information that can then maybe perhaps be transferred to human lives.
That's right.
I mean, we understand you're going to sequence genomes, look at the biome of the 10,000 dogs that are in the larger study. How are you going to do that? Do people take their dog to a vet or something? What happens there?
So we're going to be watching 10,000 dogs over their lifetime, collecting samples. For all 10,000, we're going to collect cheek swabs, and we can use those to sequence their genome. And that then allows us to genetically map variation among dogs.
And, will people do this themselves, get the cheek swab, or
will
you go to them?
We will send the cheek swab to people's homes. They will swab their dog's cheek. It's really easy. Put it in an envelope.
I don't know. You try the dogs I've had would not let me swab their cheeks, but people will do this, I'm sure.
And if you need help from your veterinarian, I'm sure that he or she will be happy to help you. And then you just send that cheek swab in, and we will cover the cost of sequencing the genome of your dog. And then we will ask whether variation in the genome is associated with variation in the frequency of particular diseases or behaviors. And we'll also collect environmental variation, air quality, water quality, whether you use pesticides in your home, whether you have carpeting or hardwood in your home, how close the parks are, all that kind of environmental information. And then for as many dogs as we can afford, at least 1,000, maybe more, we'll also collect molecular biology information. And that tells us not only which genes are affecting which traits, but why they're affecting traits. It also gives us the opportunity to identify molecular biomarkers that might predict, for example, whether a dog is at high risk of a particular disease, or if it's diagnosed with a disease, what its prognosis might look like.
Well, and are you going to share this information with the owners? Because some of that might be hard to handle, knowing that, oh, my dog's already got something I didn't even know, or has a prognosis that they will get something, at least they have a strong chance.
One of the really exciting things to me about the Dog Aging Project is that it's what we call an open science project. So we will share the data after protecting the privacy of the owners. We will share the data with anyone who wants to study it, with all scientists. Of course, we'll also share individual data about a dog with the owner through the veterinarian. And that can only be a good thing because the veterinarian can help the owner make better decisions. Of course, a lot of the information, we may not yet know what it means, but over the years, by doing the science, we will come to know what all of this information means, for example, with the molecular data that we collect.
Give me an example of the dream that you have that will also translate to learning about human aging.
So first, I want to tell you that this project is already fulfilling a lifelong career dream for me to create a team of experts in all these different disciplines to do truly interdisciplinary science. I think the most exciting questions are often in between the disciplines. And the Dog Aging Project is the most interdisciplinary project that I've ever been involved in. That's been really exciting. But there's also the potential that we'll learn not only about aging in dogs, we'll also learn about aging in people. Dogs get the same diseases that we get. Their healthcare system is second only in sophistication to our own healthcare system. They live in our environment, and in many ways, they experience our environment more intensely than we do. They're often home all day while we're off at work. They're more likely to drink water from the tap rather than from a bottle. They're rolling in the yard rather than walking on it like we do. So what we learn about dogs is likely to apply to humans. And because everything is sped up in dogs, dogs also have the potential to be what we call sentinels. So everything is sped up in dogs, including the probability that they get a particular disease. So if there's an environmental risk factor, for example, there might be an air pollutant that's associated with some disease, it might take decades to show up in humans. if we see a cluster of that disease in dogs after just a couple of years, we can then turn to their owners and make sure that they're doing okay, give them preventative care potentially. So there are a lot of ways in which the Dog Aging Project can help human health and aging as well.
Well, you say sentinel. They're the canary in the coal mine thinking that we might see health problems in a cluster of dogs and realize that down the road that same health problem may impact humans.
That's right. I mean, for example, we're seeing the spread of new vectors of infectious disease throughout the country. Sometimes the signs of those diseases show up first in dogs who are outside a lot more than it does in humans.
Fascinating. That's Daniel Promislow, founding director of the Canine Longevity Consortium and now co-leader of the Dog Aging Project. If you want Fido or Mo, if you have a Mo too, to be involved, just go to hearnow.org and you can start the process there. Daniel, thank you so much.
It's really been a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you.
And again, the Dog Aging Project is open to dogs of all ages, all breeds, as long as they live in the U.S. Like, no flights are provided to get them here. There's no cost to participate.
70% of Venice, Italy is underwater. If it sounds dire, that's because it is. Some experts claim that this kind of flooding could occur with nearly every high tide, which means Venice as we know it could be gone by the turn of the next century. A devastating reality for a city that's home to priceless history, art, and architecture. Joining us now from Venice is Melissa Kahn, director at Save Venice, a charity to protect Venice artworks, which was founded after the historic flooding in Venice in 1966. Melissa, welcome.
Hello.
So we heard that Venice was hit yesterday with its third high tide in a week. You've lived in Venice for 31 years. What's the situation there now?
Well, today we had more high water, but not as extreme. From our Save Venice office, we can see the Grand Canal and we can monitor pretty well from our rooftop position. Now we're normal.
One of your group's conservation projects is an ancient church on an island in the Venetian Lagoon. Tell us a little bit about that church and its historical significance and what it's facing in these flood waters. It's got to be tremendous.
Yes, that's the island of Torcello. I was actually there this morning. The island of Torcello was the first area in the northern lagoon that was settled according to the historic founding dates of Venice in the year 421. The church that we're dealing with there, Santa Maria Assunta, was founded in the 6th century with mosaics from the 10th and 11th century. And so that church right now has gone underwater several times with up to about a foot and a half of water in the interior. But the problem is that the water outside the church in what's left of the baptistry, it's not draining. Water is filling up possibly from underneath from the water table. And so we're quite concerned about the foundations because of this accumulation of water.
Oh, my gosh. It's got to be such a stressful situation. There's so much history there. Tell us about St. Mark's Church in the main square. It was consecrated in the year 1117. I mean, it's just so hard to wrap our heads around this history. It's known
yes.
as the Church of Gold for its gold mosaics. But we hear that it sits on the lowest part of the city. What's the concern about damage there? And what does this church really represent to Venetians?
Well, it's very much the heart of Venice. It's the center, the Piazza San Marco, the symbol of Venice, because it's dedicated to St. Mark, who's the patron saint of Venice. The square itself floods on a fairly regular basis, as does the atrium of the church. But with this exceptional high tide Tuesday night, and again, quite a bit yesterday, there was considerable water in the church and also in the crypt of the church. And so these exceptional high tides that hit the church with the mosaic floor and mosaics on the wall, the salt water, even when it recedes, the salt remains. And as salt dries, it actually increases in volume about 5 times. And so you have to keep rinsing with fresh water to get rid of the salt. But at the meantime, the pressure of all the water has been undermining the foundations and possibly under the church itself.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, how do you mitigate something like this? And what are you all doing to at least lessen the damage that you expect to happen to these historical places?
Well, the first thing to do is to rinse everything, you know, very simply with fresh water. And that's what everyone is involved, there are groups of volunteers. And then after that, it's a matter of really doing more serious studies. Santo Cello, we're going to do a geo-radar study to see, confirm the integrity of the marble slabs on the floor to understand if the subfloor, the sort of the dirt foundation of the church, to see if it's shifted.
Venice is really a floating city. It's so extraordinary in that it's really built on islands in the middle of the Venetian lagoon, as you mentioned earlier. So that water is something that Venetians, I can imagine, are used to dealing with. But this is just of another proportion.
Right. I mean, the water has always been very important to Venice. It's founded, it's a group of islands, basically in a swamp that the Venetians build up over time. The water was a sense of protection for the Venetian community because they couldn't be easily invaded. So the waters became sort of the city walls. Venetians always were able to sort of control the canals, control the rivers that ran into the Venetian lagoon. And over time, that has become more difficult, certainly with rising sea levels and maybe a little bit less diligence in keeping up on some of the infrastructure and the canals. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a bit much more difficult to keep ahead of the water.
Yes. Melissa Kahn is Venice director of the New York City-based charity Save Venice. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And Robin, let's listen to some music composed for and performed at St. Mark's Church, Claudio Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The impeachment hearings go into their second week with testimony expected from 8 current and former Trump administration officials.
And President Trump says he's considering testifying in writing to the committee after the House invited his testimony.
We will have all the latest next time, Here and Now.